May it please the court.
Certainly.
The trial court, the Honorable John E. Beadham, entered judgment on the pleadings against the Missouri Municipal League, the City of Springfield, and Missouri Charter City, and Richard Sheets on claims that the enactment of two bills in the 2014 session of the General Assembly violate provisions of the Missouri Constitution. In the state's brief, Mr. Layton has raised, in different order than we briefed, the questions, and he raised the enactment challenges that we assert under Article 3, Section 28 of the Missouri Constitution. And I'd like to address the standing issue first, as we briefed it, because I think there is some significance in clearing a couple of things up. The state's position is that a case that was handed down in the 1990s wherein the school district challenged a statute governing contributions to teacher retirements, and there was some language in that statute which would imply that no local government within the state of Missouri would ever have standing to challenge on retrospective or special legislation grounds a statute passed by the General Assembly. Previous to that, in 1981, however, this court entered an opinion that was directly on point with legislation that was very much like the legislation that we're talking about here. In the case of Planned Industrial, which we've cited, the court ruled that a city did have standing to assert a retrospective law challenge, as well as standing to assert a special legislation challenge, finding that under the Declaratory Judgment Act, the city is a person which has standing, and finding further that the interests of the city in managing its right-of-way and the important interests of the residents who entrusted that responsibility to the city required finding standing. And the court substantively ruled that legislation which purported to grant rights to private telephone and telegraph companies violated the retrospective legislation clause of the Missouri Constitution. House Bill 649 does the same thing in the year 2014. The particular concern is with the amendment of Section 67.1842(1) by adding subsection 6, which was actually added, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we discuss the enactment issues relating to Article 3, Section 28. This section was enacted for the first time, or purportedly enacted for the first time, in 2013. What it states is that any public utility that has been legally granted access to a political subdivision's right-of-way cannot be required to enter into agreements or have any other restrictions placed upon it for purposes of continuing, and it grants general access and a right to remain. So not only does it expand the rights that an existing public utility would have in municipal right-of-way, but it makes them permanent, which was very similar to the legislation that was challenged in Planned Industrial in 1981. This court found in 1981, and I believe the court should find again here, that a municipality does have standing to challenge legislation which impacts its right-of-way. Why does it matter? Municipalities have the responsibility by statute of allocating access to and managing right-of-way. They have tort liability for what goes on in right-of-way. And as the court found in 1981, it defied reason to suggest that the hundreds of miles of right-of-way in the city of St. Louis didn't confer a standing interest upon the city to challenge that legislation. That basis for finding standing exists still. The decision from the Savannah R3 case that is cited by the state would imply a broader prohibition against finding standing, but as Justice Limbaugh in his dissenting opinion noted, there really isn't any way of confining the ruling that was made in that case to its decision. And the concern was that there wasn't, in his words, a logical firewall that separated a ruling that dealt with public school teacher retirement funding into finding things that weren't really decided by the court. The state believes, and the trial court agreed, that the Savannah R3 case should be followed and should bar standing by a political subdivision to challenge right-of-way legislation. The concern would be the same. Either there is no finding in the Savannah case that in fact planned industrial was overruled. So the best the state can say is that sub silentio, a teacher's retirement decision, overruled a standing ruling by this court that dealt expressly with public right-of-way. Sub silentio rulings, sub silentio overrulings are disfavored. They have very little precedential value. And therefore, the Savannah R3 case has no precedential value at all, does not overrule planned industrial, and should not be followed. With respect to the enactment issues, as the state pointed out in its brief, if the court rules that the two bills we're challenging, SB 649 and SB 650, from the 2014 session of the General Assembly, were not properly enacted, that does away with the rest of this case, because then we are back to where we began. So what is the defect in the enactment? Article 3, Section 28 has two clauses. There is the clause that deals with the revival or reenactment of prior legislation, and there is the clause that deals with amending existing law. In 2013, the laws that we're talking about here were passed for the first time in House Bills 331 and House Bills 345. Before those bills went into effect, the Circuit Court of Cole County entered an injunction against their effectiveness, and in October of 2013 ruled that they were unconstitutional and held them to have no validity or effect whatsoever. Thereafter, when it was time to pre-file bills, there were sponsors of the ones we're talking about today, 649 and 650, Senate bills, which used the language from those two stricken laws for purposes of setting out the law as it appeared to exist because it had been published in the revised statutes that way. But that elevates what is in the revised statutes to a form that the Constitution doesn't give it the right to have. The Constitution requires in Article 3, Section 28, that if we're going to revive a law or reenact a law, that it has to be treated as if it was a new law. And one of the arguments that the state has made repeatedly is that, well, the circuit court judgment went up to appeal to this court. That fact, the filing of a notice of appeal from Judge Joyce's 2013 decision striking HB 331 and 345, that would have opened up the ruling that she had to either being reversed and set aside, to being modified, to being stayed, or anything else. But none of that occurred. Judge Joyce's judgment stood for the entire time that the bills were being pre-filed the next session, 649 and 650, the time when they went through committee, were debated, passed, signed by the governor, and went into law. It was not until after all of that happened that the state's motion to dismiss its appeal of Judge Joyce's ruling occurred. The state's position is that somehow or the other the filing of that appeal did not allow the validity of Judge Joyce's decision to stand and have effect.
Do you agree the appeal made her judgment not final?
I do not agree with that. It would be a circuit court judgment that would be entitled to have all of the provisions of finality unless and until it was modified by the trial court. While the trial court had jurisdiction to do that, there was an injunction, the trial court may have been able to do that, unless it was stayed, the validity of it and the effect of that judgment was stayed, or it was reversed. The circuit court has original jurisdiction and it entered a judgment that was final for all purposes.
So what would happen, and I know you're saying that you have to use, therefore have to go back to the original language, and set it out and say how it was being modified by the second year of legislation. What if in the midst of that process, after that had been introduced, this court reversed what Judge Joyce did? So now the amended bill was valid and there was yet another bill. I mean, the target would vary constantly under the way you're arguing it. You would not know which bill you need to modify and it could change over time. And people could be subject to varying bills during the course of that year while it's on appeal. How do you address that practical concern?
A highly legitimate concern, Your Honor. I agree with that. Something very similar to that happened in the state of Washington, and I cited the state of Washington case for the reason that the Washington Constitution has been cited by Missouri case law before because it has a provision very similar to Article 3, Section 28. And the Supreme Court of Washington said, you know, this is a highly unusual situation, but we can't ignore the Constitution and vary those requirements just because we find ourselves in a novel and unusual situation. This was a situation where the law never was, as it was purported to be amended, and you can't amend a law that isn't.
And are there cases that have said that, that if there's a circuit court judgment while it's on appeal, the constitutional provision is invalid and as if never enacted, as opposed to its effect stayed while we decided it? Are there cases dealing with that very tricky point on which you all disagree?
We've never had the little interstitial piece of this that the court brings up, as they did in the state of Washington. It happened in the state of Washington, and it hasn't happened previously in Missouri, because we just haven't had a situation where this General Assembly, at least in any reported case that I have come across, has attempted to amend a law that didn't exist. And it does. It places them in a situation where they would have to look.
But
to
what makes up, what, tell me why it doesn't exist because of the trial court's order.
Because there's a trial court order holding that it is invalid for all purposes.
And that's on appeal. And so getting back to that question, how does that not affect its validity? The fact that if it was not appealed, that would be final. Since it's on appeal, it's not final.
We did cite the court to a number of cases that hold that a circuit court, Missouri Circuit Court injunction, is final for all purposes, even while on appeal, unless it is modified or reversed or stayed. And the same would apply in this situation. It would be as if there was a different standard for the legislative process as opposed to all other processes. And it would be actually creating greater confusion to have a situation where the General Assembly had a different set of laws than everyone else had to follow. I understand that they are legislating, but at the same time, the people are entitled to have transparency in this issue of what is actually happening here. And that's where it was misleading and where it was prejudicial to the other people in the General Assembly who were not as familiar with the history of this legislation. It's prejudicial to the press, it's prejudicial to the public, and it's prejudicial to interest groups.
But how do you reconcile your procedural argument with Section 30666, in which it indicates that when the Missouri Supreme Court or federal court of competent jurisdiction makes a final ruling, how do you reconcile?
That is the legislature stating what the reviser of the statutes is supposed to do, but it doesn't change the fact that that's not the law, and it can't be amended because Judge Joyce's judgment was final, had not been reversed, modified, or stayed, and for that reason, the fact that that's in the statute doesn't change what the General Assembly can do. It simply changes what the dictates what the reviser of the statutes may do. See, I have just a few seconds left, and I've been told previously at other courts there's no obligation to use all of your time, and I'm finished for the time being. Thank you.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Sure.
Let me turn first to the retrospective application question. This court, of course, can decide contrary to Savannah R3 and can decide contrary to planned industrial. But the rationale of Savannah R3, I believe, is persuasive. Cities lack vested rights vis-a-vis the General Assembly, except where those rights are granted by two cities by the Constitution. As I think about that, I think about if one of my children gives a particular privilege to one of my grandchildren. My grandchildren don't get vested rights in that privilege because those rights are dictated by my children as their parents. The General Assembly decides what rights cities and other political subdivisions in the state of Missouri have, except where there is a constitutional declaration that a city or a county or some other political subdivision has a right. There is, however, nothing in the Missouri Constitution that gives the cities here the kinds of rights they are trying to protect. In fact, the General Assembly could abolish the city of Springfield. If it chose to do so, it could decide that in counties, assuming it didn't violate the local law provision, it could decide that in counties that are dominated by a city like Springfield, the county and the city, they shouldn't overlap. They shouldn't duplicate services, and it could simply say, we aren't going to have cities in those counties anymore. The General Assembly has that authority, and that's why this court, Savannah R.
Well, but while they do exist, it has to follow the law in dealing with them. And so they're saying, opposing counsel is saying, that includes the law against retrospective
And this court said in Savannah R. 3 that that doesn't apply to political subdivisions because the General Assembly, that is a provision to protect individuals and not provisions.
And where did that come from? I know there's an early case saying that, but where did it come from in that case, and where did it disappear to for 100 years?
Well, in Barton County versus Wassler, which was an 1871 case.
Yeah, there
was the first case that I
that addresses that, and that's about it. I mean, that really, I can't say it comes completely out of the blue because it doesn't come out of the blue, but it does appear really in modern case law for the first time in Savannah R3.
And I'm just asking seriously, what do we know? Where did Barton get that understanding?
No.
Because it's not actually in the Constitution. It may be what it meant, but where did it come from, and why was it not discussed for the next 100 years, where then it was?
Well, frankly, I don't know how many times political subdivisions tried to invoke the retrospective law provision in that 100 years. I guess in planned industrial they did, but there isn't a lot of occasion for cities to do that. So
was there some discussion that, based upon the placement of where the right was, that it was in the Bill of Rights that it applied to citizens as opposed to political subdivisions?
Yes, and there is a bright line that can be drawn by saying that the things in Article 1 relate to citizens and not to the creations of the state like political subdivisions. If you don't have that bright line, then you have to figure out what the line is for who can assert things under Article 1, and to do that you may go to the language of the particular right at issue. And because some of the rights are described differently than other rights. But there is certainly a bright line to say that when the General Assembly authorizes the creation of a political subdivision, that political subdivision does not inherit the rights that are generally allocated to individuals under Article 1. Let me turn to the question of the published bill. There are, as Mr. Berry said, two clauses in Article 3, Section 28. But they end this way. The first ends, shall be set forth at length as if it were an original act. And the second ends this way, shall be set forth in full as amended. So the purpose of that particular provision was to prevent the General Assembly from passing a bill that simply says, from Section 5033, remove the word not. And it says that when you read the bill, you have to be able to see what the bill will say as if it were an original act or in full as amended. And there's no question but that this bill met that requirement. The question becomes solely whether the words stricken out were the right words. And there were two options. And although I believe that the General Assembly took the better of the two, if the General Assembly had taken the other, I would be here defending that position as well. There is not a clear answer to that question, and thus the General Assembly's choice could not be clearly wrong. And under this court's precedence, that would mean that the statute should be upheld.
Well, what about opposing counsel says that the legislature really needs to know what changes they're being asked to make, and if the intermediate bill is invalid, somebody might look at the proposed changes from it and say, boy, I like these modifications. They're not nearly as bad as that one last year. Whereas, in fact, if he is correct and say it came to this court and this court affirmed that the intermediate bill was improper, they would actually be enacting something they hated because they thought they were just modifying the intermediate bill.
That is
how
a risk.
How can they know?
That is a risk, and the only way they know is to actually look at some of the legislative history.
But isn't the purpose of requiring these things to be set out so that they have it more easily available so that there is no confusion about what's being modified?
Well, I think that the purpose, the real purpose of the provision is what comes at the end of both clause, which is to set out the entire language as if it were passed originally. The stricken out, sure, the purpose is to give someone an idea, but here, at the time that this was written, at the time it was introduced, at the time it passed the House, at the time it passed the Senate, at the time that the governor signed it, that was not clear because we were still on appeal.
And what if there had been no appeal? So we had Judge Joyce's order, and then legislation were introduced. Would it have been introduced as if there had been no intermediate bill and you were modifying the one previously? Say there had been no appeal of Judge Joyce's decision.
I think that would be a harder question to answer. Judge Joyce ruled in October, and if there had not been an appeal, the decision would have been
final.
You
understand my point. Does it depend on there being an appeal? And if so, I mean, say it if she had ruled in August,
yes.
There was plenty of time. So then that comes down to the question we were asking your opposing counsel, what's the effect of the appeal? What's the effect of the judgment once appealed? Is it a final judgment? Does it have effect even if you don't have it stayed?
It is not a final judgment in the sense of disposing of the issues that are pending in the case. It is a final judgment for purposes of appeal. And given that there was an injunction, the injunction is effective absent a stay. But the injunction is an injunction against enforcement of the statute. The injunction is not an injunction that says to the General Assembly, oh, and ignore that you put it on the books. That would be a different thing than this.
So but she both held it invalid and entered an injunction, and you're saying absent the stay, the injunctive relief is still there, but
yes.
But the substance of the rest of the substance of the judgment is on appeal.
It's still at issue and still on appeal.
Okay.
If there had not been an appeal, then I think that the better course would have been, and maybe the only course, but the better course would have been to use the prior language, but it was on appeal. Let me turn for a moment to the special law analysis, and if you look at the reply brief, you can see that really on the substance we get down to a question of grammar in a sense. The prior bill, the one that was used as the reference in writing this bill and that Mr. Berry says shouldn't have been used, the prior bill said that it applied to those who have rights that someone has a right that has legally been granted access to the political subdivisions right of way prior to August 28, 2001. And I can understand why it was in the prior case there was a claim, not reached by Judge Joyce, there was a claim that was a special law because it said if you had a right by August 28, 2001, then you get this, and if you didn't have a right of way by that time, then you don't get this, can't get this. But they took that out. They took the date out. And so the language now just says, has legally been granted access to the political subdivisions right of way. Anyone at any time who has legally been granted access to the political subdivisions right of way gets the benefit. That's not a closed class. It is not a special law. And they have failed to state a claim as to that. Finally, let me turn to the Hancock Amendment. What a fascinating standing question. Because the language of the Hancock Amendment is that standing is granted to any taxpayer of the state, county, or other political subdivision. So the question that is raised here is whether there has to be a tie between the plaintiff and a political subdivision that they say is going to incur costs. To put it in geographic terms, the question is whether someone who lives in rural Pemiscot County could sue saying that this will cost the city of Tarkio a certain amount of money. Well, I think the answer should be no, but it's an answer of first impression in this court. Certainly there's never been a case in which this court has suggested that the language of the Hancock Amendment is so broad that any person who is a taxpayer of any part of the state of Missouri, any county of the state of Missouri, or any political subdivision in the state of Missouri can sue for an unfunded mandate that is imposed on any other political subdivision, even though it has no impact on their particular tax burden. That, in fact, to allow that would be inconsistent with the way that we look at the relief sought and the proof required in a Hancock Amendment case. The relief that is granted in a Hancock Amendment case is to excuse a particular political subdivision of compliance with a particular state law.
What if you were, and I know that's not the facts here, but what if you were a resident of rural Greene County and you were challenging something that Springfield was doing?
Well, I think you'd still have the same problem. If you don't have, as a resident of rural Greene County, an interest in whether the city of Springfield is incurring a cost that that the state hasn't appropriated funds to cover, because it doesn't affect your taxes. And so the rule ought to be that you have to plead and prove that this will affect you. And in this instance, we don't have that. The only taxpayer here is a taxpayer who alleged in the petition that he is a resident of Cole County. There is no allegation that this taxpayer resides in any city, whether it is a member of the Missouri Municipal League or otherwise. So we have a county taxpayer. And then, although there's a statement in the brief that there is that there are impacts by this statute on counties, there is no allegation in the petition that there is any impact of this on counties. So we come down to the question again, is the language of the Hancock Amendment so broad that any taxpayer anywhere in the state of Missouri can sue and thus make their case by proving that someplace, somewhere else in the state, there will be some additional cost that the state has not appropriated funds to cover? This court should not construe the Hancock Amendment standing provision nearly so broadly. Traditional standing requires a personal interest, and the court should endorse the concept that even under the Hancock Amendment, there has to be a personal interest in order for someone to bring suit. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to first address the issue about whether or not the Constitution of Missouri grants a specific standing to a municipality, and what rights does a municipality have to assert standing to challenge retrospective or special legislation. Keep in mind, the pleadings indicate, and it is a fact, that Springfield is a constitutional charter city. There is a provision in the Constitution that gives Springfield the authority to legislate and to govern its right-of-way. And therefore, we do have a basis in the Constitution for this particular plaintiff to have standing to challenge legislation which impacts its right of way. With regard to the special legislation issue that Mr. Layton spoke to, the removal of the date, 2001, from section 1846.16 doesn't fix the problem. It is special legislation because it deals with people who have, public utilities in particular, which have right-of-way, public right-of-way access. It does not give any rights to those which do not already have right-of-way access, in the sense that the class is closed. Whether you put the any date in there or you don't, the statute closes the class, and therefore...
Mr. Layton points out that anyone else who then applies for and is granted a right-of-way then would be in the same class. You don't have to keep reapplying. That right extends on indefinitely. Therefore, it's open.
It would be open if you looked at it as of somebody that was granted, but those people don't have the unconditional, those public utilities don't have the unconditional right that those have which are already grandfathered existing users. The city can place permitting and contract requirements on them to grant them the access.
Their initial access.
And so anybody who doesn't have access now can have contract terms and can have permitting provisions imposed upon them, and it's anti-competitive, and it impacts the cities in the sense that that is a group that has a special and vested right that nobody else has unless and until they are first granted permission or contractual access. With respect to the Hancock standing issue, These bills deal with political subdivisions. Cole County, Missouri is a political subdivision, and a resident of Cole County, as Mr. Sheets, does have standing under the declaratory judgment action. He is a person who does have an interest, and he has standing under the Hancock Amendment to bring that issue. But more importantly, the cities that are members of Missouri Municipal League have standing to challenge this legislation, and therefore granting standing to them and either ruling consistent with what we have requested in the petition or remanding for further consideration by the circuit court is the proper thing for this court to do.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.